Well, welcome to our class on now the creation of the angels. But in addition to that, as you see from your reading in St. Augustine, we're talking about the meanings of the term day, night, evening, morning. And this is why I'm so grateful that we're just able to have a whole year on this, because just that one verse, I have just enough time today to talk about that one verse. Years ago, the one year that I taught ninth grade religion here once, and I had done it once before at my previous school, where Holy Rosary in Anchorage, Alaska. And it was the first year that I was teaching ninth graders. I remember the first semester, what I did was I had them, all we read was Genesis 1 through 3. And I would have them memorize like four verses at a time or something like that. And then I would use St. Thomas and Fathers and give them that. And then second semester, I did the same thing with the Sermon on the Mount. Like they would have to memorize three or four verses, and then I would use St. Thomas and comment on that. And that was one of my, I consider that just one of my favorite experiences, bringing that to ninth graders. You know, just a whole year of Genesis 1 through 3 and the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5, 6, 7. Love to be able to take small things and go deep. And they really enjoyed it. They got a lot out of it. So let's turn to the task at hand. The most basic question that people have is, well, if the angels are being created, like, why isn't it narrated? Like, why is that not part of the story? And you always have to consider the audience. Moses may be receiving the fullness of revelation from God, but he has to think about the way that to give this to the chosen people in a way that is going to help them and not cause possible harm. Remember, when Moses comes down from the mountain, he is bringing the revelation from God. There's all this noise, remember? And Joshua wonders about the noise. Hey, it's battle. You know, maybe they're having some kind of battle. And Moses makes the observation, no, it is not the cry of those who are victorious, nor the lament of those who are defeated. It is the sound of revelry that I hear. They are whooping it up with what? The golden calf. Okay? Moses needs to get people to understand that there is one God and only one God. Are from at the front end of this revelation, does it help to tell the chosen people that there are tens of thousands of tens of thousands of divine beings below God? No. Okay? This is the point that St. John Chrysostom makes. The creation of the angels is given in a veiled way because you do not want to mislead a group of people who are already given to polytheism, who are already given to worshiping many gods. And in general, as you look through the Old Testament gives this very slow and progressive revelation about the angels. For most of Genesis, they look like human beings. They just look and act like human beings. And it isn't until the book of Tobias, for example, Raphael will tell Tobias, or Tobit, I should say, he will tell him, I appear to eat and drink with you, but I am a spirit, right? He lets him know his spiritual nature. It's no accident that that is a book that takes place during the Babylonian captivity, because it's when the chosen people come back from Babylon, they are finally purged of their polytheism. They are no longer worshiping statues and stones and Baal and Moloch and Ashtoreth. They are done with that. The Babylonian captivity is finally what gets that out of their system. What?
Did you say how long the Babylonian activity was? I
mean, 70 years.
70 years.
70 years.
Were they there another time longer, or another group of them, like the first, the two divisions? It was only 70 years.
70 years.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And why that, of all the things that could have done it, did it? You know, I don't. But that it was probably a long time coming. And finally, they are able to understand God as God, not as a God among gods, or the biggest of the gods, or the greatest of the gods. No, that this God alone is God. Remember, this is the reason why it is, among other reasons, that people want to date the Pentateuch after the exile, because they want to say nobody before that had an idea of there really being one God. So they finally evolve or develop to the state of having one God, and then they, right, put it back. They put the revelation of this, or the understanding of this, they project it back into Moses. Okay, when, right, the traditional account was, no, these people are monotheists not because of some gradual cultural evolution in that direction, but because God gave this original revelation to Moses. And then C.S. Lewis has this wonderful phrase, spends most of the Old Testament hammering into their heads the kind of God that he is. And so, yes, at the end of that process, they finally get it. It's almost like these things that you tell your kids and you tell them and tell them, and finally some point in their like mid-20s, maybe early teens, or late teens, but usually like early 20s or mid-20s, they come home and tell you these things that you have been trying to tell them their whole life. And it really does seem like a revelation, doesn't it? In any event, the reason that they were in some way able to come to that is you were trying to get that across to them. And at some point, right, the lights went on, right, and they got it. Okay? And God has been trying to get this into their heads. So, at the beginning, you're not going to be told explicitly he created the angels. St. Basil will talk about how it is that there's a way in which the spiritual creation happens before the physical creation, if we can talk about before, that the very existence of the light, that the first thing that is the light, already implies something spiritual, right? It already implies something above the material. If you're talking to an unlettered, illiterate, primitive people, the least physical, the most spiritual thing you're going to be able to point to in some ways is light. Light is something, light, the air, these are the things that, you know, they aren't dense and thick and whatnot. Where do I want to go? Let's go to the days here. Solar versus symbolic. Okay? When I talk about a solar day, right, a 24-hour day measured by the sun, symbolic, that there's something figurative about the day. Okay? And as you read in Augustine, very early on, people are seeing, early Christian writers are not thinking of these days as 24-hour days. That's very early on. That's not I think the black legend, as it were, is that everybody thought of it as a 24-hour day until historical critical scholars came along in the 1830s and realized that a day needed a sun. The idea is that nobody could have figured that out. As early as Origen, in fact, this is, where's my Origen? No, here we go. Here is Origen writing 200 AD. So he's writing, you know, significantly before St. Augustine. In these narratives are intermingled not a few things: the historical order of the narrative being interrupted and broken up, the attention of the reader might be recalled to an examination of the inner meaning. And one of his first examples: who is there possessed of understanding that will regard the statement as appropriate that the first day, the second day, the third day, in which there's both evening and morning are mentioned, existed without a sun, moon, or stars? The first day, even without a sky. Okay? This is 200 AD that people already can figure out there's something about the significance of the word day that doesn't mean a sun and a sky. Because you don't have a sky yet, and you don't have sun, moon, and stars until the fourth day. So there's something about what day means on that first day that doesn't signify a solar day. Okay? You're seeing it in St. Augustine. You could say, well, that's later. That guy's a kind of a 4th century guy, golden age of the church fathers. Yes, but it's an origin as early as 200 AD. In other words, as early as you have people who are really scholars and looking at these things in a scholarly way, they notice it and they start commenting on that significance. For Augustine, both Augustine and Origen will comment on how it is that the first day is not called the first day. It's called evening, morning, one day. And then the other days are called second, third, fourth. Why call it one day instead of the first day? St. Augustine famously will say that really all these things are happening at once. One day signifies that there's actually one day of creation if you were sort of looking at it historically. But the reason that you have second, third, fourth, fifth is because it's as if what God is doing is showing you the parts of the plan. It's like the plan is all unfolding at once, but he's showing you this, then this, then this, then this, so that you see how the plan fits together. It would be like you were watching a narrative in which there are different characters and different storylines, but they're all doing the same thing. They're all at the same time. So, as it were, the camera, or if you've got a book, the narrative, is moving from one to the other to the other, even if all those events are simultaneous. Because, of course, the narrator can't give them to you all simultaneously, right? So Augustine will say, when you think of the days, don't think of a sequence. Think of, I'm seeing the parts of the plan and how the parts of the plan fit together. Basil, for example, took a different route. Basil is the one who will say, no, this is a development, this is a sequence. So he will think of it in terms of this plan which is unfolding over time. Okay? And that, of course, fits more with our kind of modern sensibilities. We like this idea of this kind of development, or if not evolution, a kind of a development over time. And that's Basil's way of reading it. But they are drawn to looking at this as a symbolic day by the language of the text. Right? When our historical critical people are doing that, it's like they already have this scientific idea. And now, since the text doesn't match the science, they talk about it in terms of the primitive understanding or misunderstanding of the people who wrote it. Whereas someone like Augustine and Origen, they're looking at how does the language of the text direct our reading? Plainly, the text doesn't guide us to 24 hours if we don't have sun, moon, and stars until the fourth day. And that's a very important principle. We never want to go to the text and say, what sense do I make of this in light of what it is that I have from science? Eventually, you may want to ask that question. But the first question you want to ask is, what does the text seem to be telling you on its own terms? What is it telling you on its own terms? Not what are your kind of pre-existing ideas or preconceptions before you come to it. What does the text itself seem to be saying? Augustine, in the reading that we had, has this very rich understanding of evening, morning, right, light, night. So that evening, morning business is not an easy one. So let me say something about it. And if you have questions, feel free to ask. Since we're not talking about a solar days or a physical sun, he says this whole business of light is going to be telling us about the spiritual. It's going to be telling us about the angels. What would it mean to have an angel have an evening and have a morning? Well, if ultimately the source of the light is God Himself, we're going to be talking about the knowledge that the angels have of the world that God has made. Because ultimately, in terms of this unfolding that's happening in Genesis, the first ones to understand all that are the angels. The angels are the ones who are getting, as it were, the first revelation of the universe and what it's about and how it runs. But remember, angels are not created in glory. Angels are not created, as it were, in heaven. Remember Augustine's term, the heaven of heavens. This is the supernatural beatitude that he intends for his rational and spiritual creatures. But it's created as a goal. It is not created as, if you like, an automatic inheritance. Now for us, very clearly, it's a goal. Okay, but even for the angels, it's a goal. They aren't created with a direct and superabundant knowledge of God. Their knowledge is infused. Right? To be an angel means that you are a pure mind, you are a pure will. You don't have a body, you never did. I find nowadays that with teenagers, I never have to explain what's going on in It's a Wonderful Life, because they're too busy watching Elf for the 20th time that they've actually never watched It's a Wonderful Life. And so I actually got tired of having to give them the backstory or give them the narration of It's a Wonderful Life to show that Clarence Oddbody, Angel Second Class, actually can't be a human being in this life. Yeah, so that's not actually something I have to disagree. I tell them, I get that Elf is enjoyable, but maybe just once, put on It's a Wonderful Life, and then you can go right back to watching Elf. Human beings don't become angels. You may talk about when Grandmama dies, she's going to be one with the angels, right? You have that, but her being with the angels means they're in the same community. It doesn't mean that Grandma it becomes this pure spirit. No, Grandma is going to get her body back. She is going to rise restored to all the beauty she had when she was 19 years old, right? Don't think that you're going to see Grandma in the afterlife and it's going to be that 80-year-old lady or 90-year-old lady you said goodbye to. No, it is Grandma restored in all her youth and beauty and energy and pluck and sassiness, right? It is going to be Grandma restored fully to who she was. She is going to have a body, okay? So angels, they are pure spirits, which means they are not like you and I. We have to like go out and find things out. We have to use our senses, our sense experience to learn. They are minds that are full of ideas that have been given to them at their creation, okay? And that knowledge that they have naturally, that they have received from God, that natural infused knowledge of the created world, that is what Augustine calls evening knowledge. It's called evening knowledge because it is still the knowledge that's just fitting to them for their nature. If you are going to understand things, as it were, in the full blaze of day, you have to understand things in glory. You have to, as it were, understand things from the light of the being that made you. You have to get the fullness of that light. So that being in heaven, don't think of it as just like, right, that big Club Med in the sky. There's this intellectual element. Every doubt, every question, everything you've ever wondered, right, that you would have a fullness of understanding of the world you live in. You would have a fullness of understanding of the universe because you are seeing it from the cause. You are seeing it from the source. Okay? So that's why we call that beatified knowledge, that glorified knowledge you get from God, that is morning knowledge. So all angels, as it were, started out with evening knowledge, and those angels that remained faithful to God received morning knowledge, beatified knowledge. And maybe for us, you could think of what it is that we have in our current condition as, in a way, being like evening knowledge. Not quite as elevated as the angels have, right? But the language of St. Paul, we see through a glass darkly, but then face to face. As if, right, we're in a condition in which there's a whole lot of believing that has to happen for us to get to that light. Okay, but you have to realize about the angels. The angels don't naturally see the vision of God. Okay, I've given this likeness before. It could be that you think, especially when you're a middle-class person, you think of the rich people all being in like the same neighborhood. Like they're over there in Richville, right, in that rich neighborhood over there. And I will tell students, you have to think of it like there's rich, like there's 5,000 square feet with your own wharf on the lake, rich. And then there's Bill Gates, 65 rooms in your house, rich. Or Will Smith, you have your own zip code, rich. Okay? So at the end of the day, no, not all rich people live in the same neighborhood. There's rich and there's like really, really far out rich. That's how you have to think of the angels and God. Your idea is they're all spiritual beings and it's like they're all hanging out in Spiritualville or something like. No, there's spiritual, like Michael, Gabriel, Raphael, and then there's God. And that's a whole neighborhood unto itself. A gated community, as a matter of fact. Okay. So, angels do not are not united to God. In fact, what we will talk about in the next session, the fall of the angels. And that's what's signified in this line, God separated the light from the darkness. God separated the light from the darkness. St. Augustine, we'll talk about that, is the fall of the angels. Again, being given to you in a veiled way. It's being given to you in a veiled way. I want to notice a Catholic theologian of the 16th century, early 17th century, Francisco Suarez. If you're precise about your Spanish, Suarez. Yes, it's this Castilian Spanish, so you have to say it like it's a TH. I had a professor in graduate school who would always correct you if you said Suarez, Suarez. Norman Wells, remember Norman Wells? He was a Suarez scholar. I'm just going to say, so I'm just a slum here and say Suarez. But Francisco Suarez has a commentary on St. Thomas, and he has a commentary on these questions in the Summa. And he is the beginning of people talking about the days of creation as literal days. So that the Bible is to be read as six 24-hour days. In the early church, that's not easy to find. It's not easy to find anybody taking that position. And I had thought for a long time that the earliest people who took that position were actually the English Anglicans in the 18th century. But Suarez is actually earlier. And his line on this is a very remarkable one. That if it weren't like 24-hour days, if it weren't 24-hour days, that would just make it confusing for ordinary people. It would be like Scripture is just trying to deliberately confuse you. So he knows Augustine's interpretation, and he just considers it, I don't want to say too far-fetched, but it would be almost an improvident God that expressed it in that way and opened it to the confusion that these days are symbolic days or figurative days. And that tends to be a line that people take in the following centuries. Just at the point that it was a disaster to do, just at the point where that was a very bad idea to do, as people's scientific knowledge was increasing, right? This is just at the point where you're starting to get these breakthroughs about the physical nature of the universe, about how it works in terms of things like gravity and all these things which we identify as the scientific revolution. That literalism arises right at the same time that that a confidence in science to explain nature arises. So when you get into the 19th century and early 20th century, that you really have this biblical literalism that those days are 24-hour days. That's relatively recent in the big picture of church theology. Okay. That is not something, it's not like we were all literalists for centuries and then we started getting these more sophisticated ideas because of the pressure of modern science. If anything, it's the opposite. There's more of this idea of how symbolic or figurative or right allegorical these things can be. And then at some point in the modern era, the lines about reading it literally started hardening. And part of the challenge then is retrieving this earlier understanding that you not only get in the early church, it's straight through the medieval, such as St. Thomas. Okay, let me return to this business of light in Basil. Where is my Basil? There we go. Work of the 6 days. This is from his second homily. And again, I didn't want to overload you with patristic text, but something I have to share with you. So in his second homily on the work of the 6 days, reason asks, was darkness created with the world? Is it older than light? So when you read the account, is it like, right, there's darkness over the face of the deep? So is there darkness first and then there's light? And here's what Basil says. Why, in spite of its inferiority, has it preceded it? Darkness, we replied, did not exist in essence, right? In like, in its fullness as darkness. It is a condition produced in the air by the withdrawal of light. What then is that light that disappeared suddenly from the world so that darkness should cover the face of the deep? If anything had existed before the formation of this sensible and perishable world, no doubt, we conclude, it would have been in light. The order of angels, the heavenly hosts, all the intellectual natures named or unnamed, all the ministering spirits, did not live in darkness, but enjoyed a condition for them in light and spiritual joy. So, in the narrative, we may be starting with darkness, but in the very nature of things, it's the light that would have preceded the darkness. And that light is that spiritual light, again, which is being signified by the let there be light. This is similar to the point that was brought up last time. Dr. Flanders, you had helped me on this. Remember, in pagan accounts, everything comes out of matter, including the gods themselves. And when you read Genesis, there's this unformed matter, so. Isn't that the same kind of thing? I mean, in fact, why is it there at all? Aren't we an ex nihilo church, right? Don't we believe that God brought everything out of nothing? Okay, but remember, you've got to think of your audience, where the audience is thinking according to what they can imagine and what they can picture. Nothing is a little hard to picture. Okay, not great for the. So what you're going to do is in the narrative, you're going to put out matter, but you're going to put it out in its least formed, rawest sort of potential, so that the reader understands things are not coming out of that raw potential. There's something else which is bringing things out of that raw potential. Because remember, in your pagan accounts, when it talks about matter, it's always matter which is already formed, already there, already where. It's earth, it's ice, it's mountains, it's water, it's something, right? It's turtles, right? The world is sitting on the back of a turtle, and turtles all the way down. There's already something there. So to if you're going to get people to understand ex nihilo, you've got to start with giving them at least something to picture that almost is next to nothing. Remember, that's the way that Augustine describes this unformed matter. It's matter next to nothing. Almost, again, raw potential. He's trying to show you something or get you to picture something which really does not exist on its own. If it's really matter in its sort of rawest potential, then this is something that never exists on its own. It's always underlying everything in the natural world. But he's going to put it out there because this is the best way to help people understand that God is really the cause and not matter. Matter is something being acted on. Matter is something being formed. But ultimately, that matter itself relies on something before it, right? Namely, God himself. So when you talk about the heaven of heavens, when you talk about that ultimate heaven, that's the first sense in which there is the fullness of light. Not just that we have these beings that are above matter, not just that are completely spiritual, right? But that we have these beings that they are intellectual beings. The thing about light is that light, most of all, makes us to know. That's Aristotle's phrase at the beginning of the metaphysics. That things become visible and distinguishable in light. And think of the language that we use for our own knowing. The language that we use for our own knowing keeps going back to seeing. Seeing and light. You know, if we had evolved from dogs, maybe all of our language would be a language of smell. Right? Because when you're a dog, you don't have color vision. Right? You can see some colors, I guess. I think they're mostly black and white. And your schnoz out there, that's what your world is. So, you know, for your dog, you are not, you know, all this wonderful clothes you're wearing and your, you know, how you've arranged your hair and, you know, what your materials in front of you. You are your body wash, your perfumes, right? Your deodorants, right? That's what you are to your dog, right? You are a whole collection of smells. When he comes up to you and he's trying to recognize you, he's not like taking a good look at you. He is sniffing you out. Okay? But our language is a language of, right? Of sight. I see what you mean. This is something that you see with your eyes. You transfer what you're doing with your eyes to your mind. Right? I see what you mean. We talk about something being in light of this or in view of that. Okay? And that's the appeal of talking about light at the beginning. We're not just talking about something physical. In fact, when you push it, we're not talking about something physical at all. We're talking about something spiritual and intellectual. Okay? We're talking about something spiritual and intellectual. That the fullness of day is being united with this being who is the source of all light because he's the source of all knowledge. Okay? We'll talk about this a little more next time, but that one would have to understand that among the angels, they're under some kind of probation. At the beginning, they're brought into existence in their natural being, and then they are offered that supernatural light. And some number of them said yes, and some number of them said no. Okay? Now, you could be sitting there thinking, why would any of them say no? Okay? And the thing to start thinking about is, well, generically, you could say pride. But here's something to think about. The order of grace is something that can subvert the order of nature. The order of grace can subvert the order of nature. In other words, there are all sorts of things that we think of as natural gifts that would put you on top. Right? Think of, if we're going to talk about intellectual light, right? Socrates and Plato and Aristotle and Newton and Einstein and so on. And yet, we are going to describe this humble woman from Nazareth as the seat of wisdom. We are going to describe this humble woman from Nazareth as the seat of wisdom. Presumably she was able to read and write. Presumably she had some degree of education. Why is it we are going to describe that as a seat of wisdom? That there is some kind of enlightenment that she has that's beyond what it is that naturally people could provide. Okay? There's some kind of think about someone like Thérèse of Lisieux. Right? Thérèse of Lisieux, you know, again, how much education? Or an even better one, one of my favorites, Bernadette de Soubirous. Bernadette de Soubirous could barely pass her catechism quizzes. She could barely pass to get her sacraments. There's a lovely scene in, not Song of Bernadette, the Hollywood one, but it's just called Bernadette, and it was made in the 80s. It's Canadian. It's one of my favorite saint movies because it's very low-key. It's not, Song of Bernadette is lovely, but it's very dramatic. It has a lot of Hollywood, you know, oomph to it. And Bernadette has none of that. It's very matter-of-fact. And remember, the priest tells Bernadette, when the lady appears to you, ask her who she is. And the next scene, you see Bernadette coming all the way up from the grotto. I am the Immaculate Conception. I am the Immaculate. She's having to say it to herself over and over again, or she'll forget. Okay? She's got to say it to herself all the way from the grotto of the priest. Right? But we're going to talk about saints having this kind of illumination that, in defiance of people who are smarter, better educated, and all the rest of it. So when you think about the fall of the angels, you have to remember that one of the things in Lucifer's mind is, if I'm the best, if I'm the highest and brightest and best of the angels, but what's being offered is being offered as a gift, all of a sudden, the natural order, he isn't at the top anymore. The natural order puts him at the top, but if now there's an order of grace, right, it can subvert that order of nature. Are you still at the top if there's an order of grace? So when you think about motivations for fall, the moment that there's something above nature, okay, the moment that there's something above nature, people who are at the top by nature can actually lose the positions that they have. And that's what you, that's why I use these examples of Bernadette and Teresa of Lisieux, and right? These are people who are very humble and very small in the eyes of the world. And yet these are the people who we consider heroes of sanctity. Before we adjourn, hey, we actually have some time. So I know this isn't an easy reading, so are there, you know, things that go ahead, you go first, Ms. Mathoon.
Two questions. That last point that you just made implies that the seven deadly sins existed with the angels.
Well, wherever you have a mind and a will, you have the possibility for turning away from the good.
Okay.
Wherever you have a mind and a will, because this is the way that Lewis puts it in Mere Christianity, in fact, when he's talking about the fall of the devil. Anytime you have a will, you can have a will that turns itself inward instead of turning itself outward. With God, his will doesn't turn outward because he's the fullness and the source of all goodness. So to the degree that, as it were, he goes outside himself, it's because he is generously bringing beings into existence that are going to share in what he has. Right? He doesn't create from need. His love, in fact, is purely liberal. He really does give and get nothing back. You can't add to a being of infinite goodness. But if you have a being that depends on other beings, the moment you have that, depends on other beings for the good, they can always want to turn from whatever the source of the good is to find their own good, to find their good in themselves.
Okay. Then the other question, and this one kind of makes me nervous, because I didn't ever think about the fallen angels as having that body of knowledge that God gave them, that full, what do you call it?
Well, they don't have morning knowledge. They have evening knowledge. Devils have evening knowledge. They don't have morning knowledge, would mean they were enjoying the beatific vision. So a devil, as a fallen angel, only has the knowledge that has been given to him by his, in his nature. In other words, the infused knowledge that he gets at his creation. If you are going to be St. Gabriel, St. Michael, St. Raphael, you have morning knowledge. You have humbled yourself to open yourself to the illumination that God gives above your nature.
So then, my brain.
No. This is not easy stuff.
So they were created as angels.
Yes.
Therefore, they got the morning knowledge.
Evening knowledge
means the knowledge that you have by your own nature. And the reason it's called evening knowledge is because the source of all knowledge is God himself. God is the day. God is the light. So if all you've got is what was given to you by nature, in comparison to getting what God would fill your mind with directly above your nature, that's evening. That's evening compared to morning, where you are receiving the light from God himself superabundantly.
Morning knowledge, like the angels saying yes to God.
Absolutely. Yeah, because there was,
that flips it into morning knowledge.
Correct.
So we don't have morning knowledge. Nobody on earth has morning knowledge. It's all
once you die and you're in.
If grandma is really with the angels, if grandma is really enjoying the beatific vision, she's got morning knowledge now. But that's why it is you talk about what we have here. You can have people who in this life, because of their sanctity, it's like they have flashes of daylight, if you want to put it that way. You know, think about St. Paul's description. I was taken up into the third heaven, where I had a vision of such things as it is not lawful to utter. It's like for some amount of time in this spiritual rapture, boom, he was seeing something of the daylight. Go ahead.
So do the angels only have one opportunity then for that yes?
Yes.
Okay, so all the angels that are in existence today will always be angels. They will
correct.
Always be fallen angels.
Correct. We're going to talk about this a little more, but briefly, angels will with their whole wills because they know everything they're going to know. You know, the reason that we are so changeable very often is because our knowledge is changeable. You make a choice, you act on that choice, and you realize, oh my gosh, this is a disaster. And then you change your mind because you acquire knowledge. Angels are not like that. They know everything at the start. So when they make a choice, that's it. So when you think about the devil, I can talk about this a little more next time. So when you think about the devil not being able to repent, it's not like, there he is, he feels really sorry and God just won't forgive him. They're not the kind of beings that can repent. They're not those kind of beings. You may have particularly stubborn children that it just seems like once they make up their mind, there's no changing it. In those moments, they are like willing like an angel, only with less right to do so. Because at least angels are stubborn from their knowledge. Whereas very often as a human being, you're stubborn sometimes in spite of your knowledge. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was thinking during the sacrifice of the Mass, during the consecration, the one picture that comes to mind is as the priest is holding up the host, you've got the angels and the,
yep.
and the saints and the church victorious and
yep.
suffering. And so isn't that kind of the glimpse of the morning knowledge?
Could be, but you're not seeing all those angels and you're not seeing all that glory. You're just seeing Father in his vestments holding up what looks like to be a piece of bread. Great. You know what? And if you are, great. Great.
Anyway.
No, if that's what I'm saying. It's not as if there aren't more moments where, as it were, the morning breaks through. But so much of our, even our faith life, is through a veil. We don't see these things directly. They're veiled. And to some degree, that could be an act of mercy. It could be that if we were to behold the realities, it would, you know, it would shock us, or it would, you know, it would overwhelm us. Put it that way. It could overwhelm us. Yeah, Glenn, this is Cesarian.
So then I'm just trying to understand this. Did evil exist at the creation of
humanity? Only potentially. So going back to what Mrs. Methuen is asking, where I have a will that's free, then it has the potential to turn in on itself. But it isn't until the will actually does that boom, now we have evil. Now we have darkness. Now we have an absence of the light. The light comes first, but then things turn from the light.
So, you know, like that firmament, is
yeah.
that the veil?
Oh, you're not blocked. Yeah, you're not blocked from heaven by a sky. It's because these are spiritual things and we are in largely a physical condition or a material condition. But I suppose there's a sort of figuratively maybe. Yeah. Very good. Next week we'll talk about follow the angels.
Arthur, would we say angels cannot forget them?
Correct.